This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for January 2014. I'm Don Scher, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Lindsay Garbutt, assistant editor for the magazine. On the podcast this month, we'll hear poems from Marion McCready.
Like the fists of women who have gone to war.
And Adam Fitzgerald.
So we see who in nullified particulars we really are.
In the January issue, we have poems by Idra Novi, Michael Robbins, Jane Hirschfield, and many others.
There's a lot to pick from, and that's precisely what we asked Christina Pugh to do. Christina is consulting editor for the magazine, and we asked her to choose one poem from the January issue that she particularly liked to read and talk about a bit. So, Christina, what did you pick?
I picked Gymnopédie number 2 by Adrian Matika.
Now, we have three of those poems, Gymnopédie, in the issue, and fans of Erik Satie will know that those pieces are atmospheric piano compositions he wrote in the late 1880s. But we should talk about what that word gymnopédie means. It's kind of a neologism.
Yeah, it definitely would have come across as a new and different and strange word for listeners to Erik Satie at the time. So yeah, much like a neologism. But it also refers to some festivals and dancing in ancient Greece in homage to fallen heroes at war. So there's definitely music and dancing involved.
Great. Well, here's Gymnopédie number 2 by Adrian Matika.
In NYC, we stocked fishes in fillets of sounds, delivery engines in ashy doors clapping shut, vendors knuckling fin and silhouette-shaped words into salty expectations. My daughter and I walked down a couple of slim bricked blocks that smelled like snapper and afro sheen with no afros in sight. On snaggletooth streets, we double took the wet alleys where things jumped off the hook like smart seafood before lunch. We parted the perfect and abundantly wintered streets. My daughter said, "I know these parts." Like a tired pianist resting on her bench.
So what drew you to this poem? It's a nice poem. Yeah. <One thing.
laughs> It is. I was drawn to the way the poem moves so well down the page. You can really feel it stepping as the father and daughter are moving through the streets of New York. And there's so many senses in the poem. There's smell, sight, hearing, sound, taste. It's full of this wonderful sensory information. And, you know, in phrases like fillets of sounds, so mm-hmm. unexpected, where you're putting a couple of different senses together, like filleting a fish, and you think of lifting the bones out of that fish. These are sounds that have been filleted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, the word that sort of leaps out at you is almost in the middle of the poem. On snaggletooth streets, we double-took the wet alleys where things jumped off the hook like smart seafood before lunch. It's really got that quality of Frank O'Hara poems, you know, sort of standing still and walking around New York. And at the same time, the affection, and O'Hara's a great poet of being affectionate, mm-hmm. and the affection here is for the poet and his daughter, which is a very lovely turn. But at the very end of the poem, something that intrigued me a little bit was when his daughter says, "I know these parts," like a tired pianist resting on her bench. I was thinking of the creaking that happens. But what do you make of that? You know, I did pause there, and I wondered, what does that mean?
For me, it was very surprising. We know from the first Gymnopédie that the daughter is most likely at an age where she would be building a snowman because it makes a reference to that. And that almost jaded quality of, "I know these parts," makes her seem much older than her years, but not in an annoyingly precocious way. Because, as you say, it's a very short quote. She doesn't get the opportunity to go on and on and on about it. And I also felt that the tired pianist was a nice reference back to Satie.
Yeah. With the piano. It could even be, "I know these tired piano parts."
Right. Yeah, right.
In terms of the sound of the poem, which I just love, I really like how It starts in NYC, mm-hmm. which really mm-hmm. sounds like gymnopédie. And I love
right.
that
yeah.
connection yeah. there to bring that classical music term into a, huh. a neighborhood or someplace that it wouldn't normally be found.
And it's wonderful, too. You know, the daughter is in all three of the mm-hmm. poems. Yes. And so the idea of the flaneur or the solitary walker is updated very nicely because it's a,
yes.
it's a poet with his daughter. And there is a warmth that arises from that that kind of mitigates the alienation of urban life that these poems take on, for sure.
Absolutely.
But it's not only about alienation, but also that companionship with his daughter.
This is the first appearance of Marianne McCready in the magazine, and we have three short poems by her in the January issue.
I live in Dunoon, which is a small town in the Firth of Clyde in the west coast of Scotland. About an hour's drive away from Dunoon, there's a range of Munros called the Addicar Alps.
Addicar Alps is the name of the first poem we're going to listen to. It's in the voice of the mountain range itself.
Addicar Alps. I have been known to birth a mountain hole, a range of them in my belly. I pop them out, one by one. The blood-cut son, born black. I could not believe the wholeness of him, the crushed diamond of his face. And then another, who flew from me, a shooting star. A twin mirror girl, whose orchid face opened and opened and opened. There were more of them, one born of water, one of fire, one for every element. But now my mountain days are done. The red night clouds, the afterbirth, the snail shell whorls of them. The unborns we named, Ben Narnain, Ben Vain, Ben Im, Ben Vorlich, and Ben Vui.
I have to explain that I was in the UK a few months ago and was at a poetry reading, and Marianne read this poem, which is the first time I met her or heard her poems. And when I heard this poem, I felt kind of ravished by it. There's sort of a masculine Yeats kind of thing that often happens when a poet tries to impersonate landscape and sort of take on things like mountains, or especially the Celtic aspect of that.
I think what really strikes me about this poem is her use of repetition. You know, the repeated Ben in the name of each of the names in the last couplet, but also right in the middle of the poem where she says, whose orchid face opened and opened yeah. and opened. It just draws out the poem in a really beautiful way, I think.
Yeah. Sometimes when you hear a poem for the first time, you know, it's hard to know what you're hearing or how to think about it or what the poem's really like. And when I first heard her read this poem, the beautiful part towards the end.
The red night clouds, the afterbirth, the snail shell whorls of them.
Became indelible in my mind. I mean, I think that it was actually those lines that drew me to the poem, because I was hearing things and then seeing them as the mm-hmm. poem directed me to.
I think it's interesting, too, how it's working as a list in some ways, birthing one after another after another. That really gets intensified in the moment that Don was just talking about as well, the red night clouds, the afterbirth, the snail shell whorls of them, and then the naming.
The unborns we named, Ben Narnain, Ben Vain, Ben Im, Ben Vorlich, and Ben Vui.
This really seems as if it's a poem in which listing is really suited to
yeah.
what's happening.
Well, you know, I thought I was very lucky to have encountered a poet and this poem. And then I thought maybe there are more. But sometimes there are, and sometimes, you know, you meet somebody or see a poem and it's really good and you have trouble finding more that are as striking to you. But we do have several in the issue. And, well, let's listen to another poem. This one is called Roses.
One quick note to avoid confusion. Marianne McCready pronounces reminder the way we would say remainder.
Roses. There is no escaping the storm of roses crisscrossed on the split-cracked wall of a dead fountain arch. There is no escaping their uterine balls expanding as a reminder of the children I never had. If you listen carefully, you can hear the vibrations, the heart drone of their petal jaw harps. And there's no going back, no in discovery of Mars or these red planets brooding before me. Light predators, sun-hatched and bloodening like the fists of women who have gone to war.
That's amazing to me, this one too.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever found roses so frightening before.
Yeah. I mean, again, especially the end of the poem, bloodening like the fists of women who have gone to war, that's almost Homeric, except that it's not the sort of masculine voice you find in Homer, but that figuration, the shorthand for amazing violence and violence of feeling, not just warlike violence, is incredible. And that image blooms from the storm of roses. And here, too, you have a poet, as sometimes you do, who sort of ups the ante in every line or so. I mean, a lot of poets would be lucky to come up with something like there is no escaping the storm of roses. You know, you could sort of see yourself resting. That's a pretty good line. That's a day's work, you know. Crisscrossed on the split cracked wall of a dead fountain arch.
It seems like so much of the work gets done through these images and metaphors.
There is no escaping their uterine balls, expanding as a reminder of the children I never had.
It's almost as if the eye doesn't have to have an expanded presence.
There is no escaping their uterine balls, expanding as a reminder of the children I never had. And that's when the sort of, you know, instead of just being kind of set pieces of clever imagery, the sort of intensely personal tone, the sort of expansion of this feeling is amazing.
Absolutely.
So very deftly done, you know?
Absolutely.
This is also the first time we've had poems by Adam Fitzgerald in the magazine. Adam Fitzgerald teaches at Rutgers in the New School, lives in the East Village, and is the founding editor of the poetry journal Maggie.
His book of poems, The Late Parade, came out last year. We have three new poems in the January issue, and we're going to hear two of them now. The first one is called Poem with Accidental Memory.
My father passed away over the summer, and it is the first poem that I remember writing after that. I'm not sure if that has any accidental or incidental or intentional meaning to it, but I don't necessarily think it matters either way, but it's something I think about looking at the poem.
And now it's something we will think about too. Here's Adam Fitzgerald reading Poem with Accidental Memory.
That we go back to life one day, the next, some other century when we were alive, when music spelled itself out to us, often incomplete, and nothing was more vague than the banality of whom to love and lose in line, the doppelgangers in rimless snow, or even now, in summer, at day, by night, when something oblivious, replete, turns back at us in idolatrous quiet, so we see who in nullified particulars we really are, at a desk of our own making, filling in for someone else's life sentence, blots drying on a silk tie, having no meaning but today's, when the loner puts his insomnia to rest.
The first thing that strikes me is just the title, Poem with Accidental Memory. Is it accidental as in unintentional, or accidental as in not essential, like he says about this memory of his father? Once I hear that, I really can't let that go when I listen to the poem, especially with the last line, when the loner puts his insomnia to rest. It's such a striking last line that, to me, gives a sense of relief to the poem.
Yeah.
Even though it's very
mysterious.
Oh,
that's really interesting. I mean, I was trying to think, too, what I could possibly say about this, but I think you've really hit on this, that it's the voice of someone seeking relief, trying to put something and someone to rest. But the title is really quite interesting. One thing I liked about it the minute I saw it was, I mean, my first thought was like, well, every poem has, every poem is a poem with an accidental memory. I mean, both in terms of the composition of the poem and then what we bring to a poem when we read it, they stimulate accidental memories, which is something, I mean, it seems very obvious, but I hadn't really thought of it that way before, that something really fundamental to poems is that they arise from and create sort of accidents of memory at every turn.
Mm-hmm. This poem strikes me as doing something really interesting with its loss. And it was interesting to hear him talk about it just briefly. But it really makes poignant that line, the banality of whom to love and lose in line.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting work with revealing and hiding the loss linguistically. In that way, it makes me think of, not to be too Freudian, but it makes me think of the whole concept of melancholia, mm-hmm. of somebody going through melancholia where the person lost is still a part of the self.
Yeah. And a doppelganger. I mean, mm-hmm. you
Absolutely.
Know, like especially if it's a parent, literally part of that person, and that person is part of you. And it's a very knowing poem too, which I think makes him melancholic, which is the most profound thoughts and feelings you have in moments like this. There's a banality to them that you confess to, because sooner or later everybody has some version of this experience. Yeah. And what he's trying to do is skirt despair.
Yeah, it's actually a really interesting contrast to a poem that's doing a much more memoir-like description of losing a loved one. Here, you know, we're looking at when something oblivious, replete, turns back at us in idolatrous quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Some really wonderful skirting around a ghostly apparition,
mm-hmm.
something that lost its personhood.
Well, yeah. Like the silk tie, even.
Yeah,
I mean, I always think a hallmark of a really fine poet is somebody who can avoid pitfalls.
Mm-hmm.
You can avoid, like, vanishing into the manhole on the street. And so, you know, there is a kind of abstraction that he's working in. And then at the end, where he has the silk tie, you know, you sit up straight a little bit at that moment in the poem, because instead of sort of abstraction and wrestling and emotion, you know, mm-hmm. there's this worn silk tie, having no meaning but today's, that sort of appealing and forlorn. But I think there's also sort of awareness of comedy in there too, which I think is nice. So that when he says, when the loner puts his insomnia to rest, there's some self-mocking there, which I think is a very nice direction for the poem to be heading in, as it stops itself, because instead of looking for sleep. I mean, what a great way to talk about insomnia,
right.
is the loner puts his insomnia to rest. And of course, what has been laid to rest is the father.
Let's hear another poem by Adam Fitzgerald. This one comes with an unusual story about how it was made.
The poet Timothy Donnelly realized that this year, Cyndi Lauper, I believe it was in October, her album She's So Unusual turned 30 years old. There's 10 songs on the album, and he figured he'd ask 9 other poets and himself to each write a poem using one of her song titles from that album. And they could do whatever they wanted with it, whether it was Cyndi related or not. And I quite like this song. I like its kind of melancholic obsessiveness, but I didn't really know the lyrics that well. So I wasn't really sure what to do, and it's always very hard for me to write a poem to order, because my mind just wants to wander. And what I decided to do was I'd keep replaying the song on my computer, but at a low enough volume that I would have to kind of be making up the lyrics that I thought I was hearing. And so the poem is kind of a homophonic translation of mishearing the song's 3 or 4 stanzas again and again and again and again.
Well, that may have been how it was written, but we'll kill the music while we listen to Adam Fitzgerald read Time After Time After Cyndi Lauper.
I'm in the barricade hearing the clock thickening you. Autumn encircles a confusion that's nothing new. Flashback to warring eyes almost letting me drown. Out of which a picture of me walking in a foreign head. I can't hear what you said. Then you say, cold room, the second that life unwinds. A tinctured vase returns to grass. secrets doled out deep inside a drum, beat out of time. Whatever you said was ghostly slow, like a second hand unwinding by matchlight. Lying back to the wheel, I shirked confusion. You already knew. Suitcases surround me. You picture me too far ahead, yet I can't hear what you've said. You say, doldrums, some secondhand wine. Love, you knew my precincts. The stone house turned out black. The scenic tunics were deep inside. Who said home? Oh, I fall behind. That very secret height blinds. Lying like a diamond, the cock thickening of you. Hunchbacked arms, eyes left behind. You'll picture me walking far, far ahead. I hear what you've done. You said, go slow. I feebly bleed out. Matthew's sermon turned out to be glass. I wander in windows soft as Sour Patch. No rewind. But something is out of touch, and you, you're Sinbad. The second date, totally mine. Lying in a vacuum, the thickening plot thinks of you. The future's not new. Touchdown. Lights. All those celebrity behinds. A suitcase full of weeds. You picture me coming to. You, too close to me to hear what you've already said. Then you say, the second wind unwinds. Doves whistle, having their dovely backs, watching out windows to see if I'm okay. See it, the dulcet moment? I'm like thicket, tinkering for you. Fusion, nothing you knew. Flashback to seagull beguiled eyes, sometimes talking to a barren lad. Such music, so unbearably droll. The hand is mine. Random picture frames off the darkness. A Turing machine. Scotch taping through windows. Stolen from deep inside, rum-beaded time. You say also, behind sequins and hinds. And I'm in the barricade, hearing the clock thickening you. Clematis enclosures, walking with news. Pollinated by a secondary grief. While something reminds you of our love.
What's really sort of interesting to me now that we've heard his introduction is his explanation of how he does this does not account for so much of what's in here. Mm-hmm. You know, in and out of the poem is a connection and relationship with another person. You know, there's an encounter. It's obviously much more complex than doing turns on the lyrics of a song that you're listening to over and over again. And I think that it's nice that the poem takes off from that. It is after Cyndi Lauper. So the kind of hungoverness of the poem, you know, everything that comes after the time after time song being played time after time is really where the poem begins.
Yeah, and as interesting as his explanation is, you almost don't need to have it because if you know the song, I mean, I still hear the song in the background of yeah. this poem anyway without knowing that it was literally in the background when mm-hmm. he was writing it.
The rhythm sometimes, it's very funny what he does when he touches on the rhythms of the song, yeah.
And there are those moments that seem as if they're in the song but might not be. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I fall behind. I don't know if that's really the song or not, but it feels almost as if it could be lifted and transposed into the song somehow.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, the poem has very nice structure to it, although it's not rigid, which is sort of interesting to me, that it's flighty. You know, it takes this sort of relentless kind of rhythm and rhyme of a pop song. And it does sort of do that hard work of converting it into a poem on its own. Because I think the temptation would be to do a pastiche, which there's a little of here, or even a parody of the song lyrics. And I like that he's more ambitious than that, that he's sort of more intense than that even.
It's interesting when you were talking and when he was talking too, it made me think back to the Gymnopédie again. And, you know, reading about what Satie said about the Gymnopédie is that it was supposed to be what he called furniture music.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So it was like part of the background in much the same way that Adam Fitzgerald describes time after time being his very low level background going on as he's writing.
Well, and it's also, he asked that question, a Turing machine.
Yes.
Which is very funny.
Yes.
But there's something in it, too, this sort of relentless computational calculation and logic that underwrites the way a song becomes part of culture, or the way a poem addresses itself to things that are happening in your life. I mean, there is something sort of odd about the mechanisms of experience and then the way we sort of riff on them and improvise on them.
Yeah, that reminds me of the ending where he says,
"Pollinated by a secondary grief, while something reminds you of our love."
That's kind of what music and poems do. You feel infected by this grief of someone else's, and it reminds you of something else that you know.
There are flashes of his considerable gifts throughout the poem, things that really stay with me that have probably very little to do with the music and the sort of pop culture, you know, amorous encounter stuff. Like
Matthew's sermon turned out to be glass.
I mean, stuff like that just sort of, you know, wakes you right up out of it. You know, you, again, when you think you know where a poem is going or what it's going to tell you, and then it says something amazingly unexpected. A lot of the images are like that too. A suitcase full of weeds.
I love, "I'm like thicket tinkering for you."
Yeah.
You know, it's like tinkering thickets. Something that you, your imagination has to do a little work to right. envision. It's quite wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's a conceit, right? It's a very elaborated and unusually surprising metaphor. And it's certainly nothing like that could have come out of Cyndi Lauper. So it's doing that kind of wonderful braiding of those things, I think.
Yeah. Well, Christina, thanks for coming onto the podcast this month. You can read Adam Fitzgerald's poems and everything else you heard on this program in the January 2014 issue of Poetry Magazine.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Lindsay Garbutt.
And I'm Don Scher. Thanks for listening.